This weekend starts right after this.
Want to know what's really scary? Seeing just how much you could have been saving on car insurance by switching to Geico. It's almost as scary as watching your dog growl at the wall and realize he sees something you don't. Get a quote at geico.com.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Election stress. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your Halloween weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour. As many as two-thirds of Americans are stressed about the 2020 election. But what exactly is causing it? We'll explore the issues. Also, on a related note, do you have friends who just can't shut up about politics? We'll have strategies on how to manage them. On the money front, an in-depth look at the personal finances of average Americans, hear what stands out, and what happens to pop-up music events that have proliferated across our cities once the cold weather arrives in force.
These kinds of events are actually happening all over the country. I'm based in New York, and where there are a lot of people who make their living playing music. And so out in Brooklyn and parts of Manhattan and in Queens, there have been these moments where musicians are getting together. They're playing in parks. They're playing in a converted parking lot.
Jennifer Smith at the Wall Street Journal on the future of underemployed musicians. Media coverage of the 2020 presidential election is a watershed moment for American journalism, and particularly for the networks and the Associated Press, which also calls election outcomes. The stakes for democracy are sky high. In the face of commercial and competitive forces, it is imperative that anchors, reporters, producers, editors, and news executives exercise restraint, precision, and care with any results. So says Alan Miller, founder and CEO of News Literacy Project. Alan, how do you see it?
Well, you know, everybody certainly recalls what seemed to be Hillary Clinton's inevitable victory in 2016. And of course, many can still recall networks prematurely calling Florida for Al Gore in 2000. And then reversing it the next day for George W. Bush before the recount. So there's a lot of concern given how hyperpolarized the electorate is and how combustible America is at this point in the wake of the pandemic and the protests and the intensity of the election. And then you've also got both sides who have raised questions about the legitimacy of the process. You know, the president has claimed without evidence that mail-in ballots create the opportunity for wide-scale fraud, and you've got Democrats concerned about voter suppression and intimidation. On top of all of that, you've got the fact that we've got a very high level of voting and a historic level of mail-in votes, which suggest indicate that it may take longer to count and to know who's actually won. So it just raises the stakes extraordinarily high, both for the television networks and the AP that will be projecting and calling the race, and for democracy itself.
We're speaking with Alan Miller. He's the founder and CEO of the News Literacy Project, and he's written a piece entitled High Stakes for Calling the Election. I know you've got information from the networks and the Associated Press about changes they've made since 2016. What's new for 2020 from these folks who often are given credit for calling elections?
Well, I think by and large, a number of them are sampling more voters. They're doing more survey work. The number 100,000 comes up a number of times. And they're also saying they're going to be extraordinarily careful and deliberate in what they project and call and transparent about their processes and how they make decisions and what they know and don't know at any given moment. Fox News and the Associated Press actually really upgraded their processes, working with an independent research firm at the University of Chicago. They do a survey that combines probability-based state-by-state polls of registered voters, and then they do a large survey in addition to that of another 100,000 online that's done both prior to Election Day and on Election Day itself. So I note that they're both ones to watch, Fox in part because of its particular role in the partisan landscape, and the high reputation and respect that its decision desk has, and the AP, because they will not make a, they do not project, they only make a call when there's enough data that they determine that who's ever trailing cannot possibly catch up.
Mm. What's the media landscape going to look like, Alan, if we do not have results November 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, you know, pick a date?
So I think it's incredibly important that the networks and journalists in general make the calendar really clear to the public, that, you know, there's, the states have typically 2 to 3 weeks after Election Day to certify the vote. That's a constitutional process. And they have until December 8th to settle any post-election legal challenges. And, of course, there's a lot of talk about things going to the court. You've also got one other factor that hasn't gotten as much attention, which is there are 21 states and D.C. have automatic recounts if the margin of victory falls below a certain percentage or if there's a tie. So these processes don't necessarily mean that there's dysfunction or that there is corruption. If it takes longer either to count the vote and make projections, declare winners, or to play out, you know, in these contexts, the process is designed not necessarily to end on election night.
Thanks, Alan. Alan Miller, founder and CEO of the News Literacy Project. Coming up next, Americans feeling stressed about the election.
When it comes to mobility, Michigan is making what the rest of the world hasn't even thought of yet. Our state is home to 2 world-class autonomous vehicle testing sites, and we're first in the U.S. for mobility-related patents. With over 500 miles of roadway equipped for connected vehicle testing, it's no wonder that everyone is moving to where it all started. So if you're ready to move into the future with your mobility business, visit planetm.com/pure-opportunity.
Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals. Thanks for being with us. A survey by the American Psychological Association finds that 2/3 of Americans say the election is a significant source of stress. What exactly are people stressed about and how can they cope? We're joined now by Lee Richardson, founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Lee, what are you hearing?
I'm hearing that everybody is stressed out. I've done more stress management sessions in the last month than I have in the last year.
Wow. So what are people saying? Like, what's actually stressing them out? Is it the candidates? Is it the messaging? Is it television? Or what is it?
I think it's everything. I mean, I saw a survey online that said over 70% of American adults report that the future of our nation is a significant source of stress. 72% that 2020 is at the lowest point in our nation's history that they can remember. But I think it's everything. I don't think it's just one thing. I think we've all been touched with uncertainty, and that has left a lot of us with despair, you know? And we our adaptive systems, our mental and our physical systems that we use to help us get through highly stressful situations, they're depleted.
Take away the pandemic. What's your experience say? Are we still as stressed about the election?
I think we are, because we look at things like job recovery and health care insurance, I think, has become more important in the last few months. And many people that have been able to work have lost their jobs. So I think that this election, our personal values are really tied in. And I think that's new for a lot of us.
So 4 years ago, when we were choosing a new president, no matter what, was it still as stressful with the two candidates involved?
Well, I think it was stressful, but I think there was less anger, because in this election, anger is everywhere. You know, there's anger over the COVID violence, and there's anger over the race demonstrations, and people are angry because people won't physically distance or wear their masks. So I think what's different is that layer of anger.
We're speaking with Lee Richardson. She's the founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas, and we're talking about coping with election stress. All right, so for some of these folks, what do you recommend here if they're feeling overwhelmed?
Well, I think, first of all, we all need to accept that we're stressed out right now, and stress is not the same for everybody, and we don't experience it in the same way. But instead of resisting or fighting it, redirect that energy. Apply that energy into something that's really important to you.
But some people can't escape that, right? They're just consumed by it. What's their path?
Well, I think you're right. And I think that those are people that need to spend a little time on self-management. You know, start with a reflection. Ask yourself, what can I learn from this? Because as you become more self-aware of your values and what you're grateful for, you'll be more focused on the positive instead of the negative.
The sun comes up tomorrow regardless, right? Like, I try to put this in perspective. I don't feel the stress. Like, I still have a fishing trip planned with my high school guys, like, in 2 weeks. I'm still going regardless of who wins the election. You know what I mean?
I think that's so important, Gordon. People need three things. One, they need something to do. Two, they need something to love. And three, they need something to look forward to.
So for you and for those who are wrestling with this, the stress doesn't end November 3rd or whenever we get the final results, right?
No,
so
it doesn't.
Then what?
Well, then I think we have to recognize the importance of self-care. You know, a lot of times I'll ask myself, okay, where do I get my energy from? Or if I'm really struggling, what kind of downtime do I need? Because the rhythm of my life, and I'm sure in a lot of people's life, got really disrupted. So what's my rhythm? What do I need right now? And a lot of the things that I used to do for self-care have been taken away from me. Mm. I've got to get creative. I've got to rethink my options. A friend of mine made a really good suggestion to me, because what I really miss, I love going out to eat in restaurants.
Yeah.
And I miss that. And she said, well, why don't you subscribe to a meal kit service? You'll be more motivated to cook, and you'll enjoy it because it's so much easier. And you know what? She was right.
So to your point, that's almost like suggesting somebody find a hobby. Find something to do.
Absolutely. Learn a new skill. I mean, with what YouTube has to offer, anybody can learn a new skill.
Thanks, Lee. Lee Richardson, founder of the Brain Performance Center in Dallas. Coming up next, what happens during the winter months to these popular pop-up music events? Well, pop-up music events have proliferated across New York City during the warmer months, giving isolated and underemployed musicians a chance to play together. The performances range from classical and bluegrass to reggae and hip-hop, drawing audiences from the neighborhood, the city, and beyond. But now what, with the seasons changing? It's a story by The Wall Street Journal's Jennifer Smith. Jennifer, explain the trend first.
Well, these kinds of events are actually happening all over the country. I'm based in New York, and where there are a lot of people who make their living playing music. And so out in Brooklyn and parts of Manhattan and in Queens, there have been these moments where musicians are getting together. They're playing in parks. They're playing in a converted parking lot. And a fair amount of them are finding some work playing for restaurants, which has sort of taken up roost on the sidewalks because of the pandemic.
Is it a case where a couple musicians tried this out and others saw this working?
You know, that could well be. There's a range of the ways that these kind of open-air gigs took place. Some really started out with, you know, solo musicians just going out and playing in the park when the weather got warmer, and then drawing, you know, onlookers, getting a lot of appreciation from the audience, and getting together with other musicians as they realized that these could be places to play. So that's one way that happened. And then, you know, with the other sort of gigs, some look more like a real gig where you get paid a set fee or maybe a portion of the bar. And there's a group here in Brooklyn called, an effort called Operation Gig, started by a guy who lives in a neighborhood south of Prospect Park. He was sort of arranged paid gigs for musicians, some of them quite well known, on the steps and porches of homes in the area.
We're speaking with Jennifer Smith, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. Her piece is called For Musicians, It's a New Gig Economy. How well known are these musicians that are taking part in the gigs?
Well, so Jim Campolongo, who's a well-known roots rock guitarist, he performed at one concert that I caught on the steps in the Ditmas Park neighborhood. There was also a Broadway veteran called Daniel Breaker, who's quite well known. He was in Hamilton when the pandemic shut down Broadway, and he's performed. He also is a musician and writes songs, and he's performed in some backyard concerts as well. Plus, there are any number of professionals who gig and tour and make their living, you know, doing jazz, classical music, all sorts of other things, and they've been popping up and performing outside when they can.
Anyone making money off these shows, Jennifer?
Some people are making some money. A number of people who had really done a lot of touring, who would appear at large venues, their income has really been socked by the pandemic. A lot of people are doing online concerts, but it's not the same, and certainly there's not the volume of gigs that many performers had gotten before COVID hit New York and other parts of the country. However, some musicians who had been, you know, playing for local bars where, again, you might just get a not large amount of money, have found that if they played for quite a while in the park for tips, that they could actually make more money. And part of that could be because people are so appreciative of the music. People who might normally have gone out to clubs to hear music or the concert halls, they don't have that right now. So when they do hear the music and come upon it outside, there's a really, a big pull. It has an impact.
Thanks, Jennifer. Wall Street Journal reporter Jennifer Smith. Coming up next, decisions for diners. So if you're working from home, are you still dressing for work? While we can all understand not wearing a tie, going to the other extreme, like an old t-shirt, is a little too casual. If you need to upgrade the work-from-home wardrobe, try Cuts Clothing. Technical apparel for the sport of business. GQ called them the only shirt worth wearing. They combine an athletic, tailored-looking fit with their custom-engineered, wrinkle-free, ultra-soft Pika fabric for a new level of fit, fabric, and function. I gotta say, I love wearing my Cut shirts. They're tough, they're durable, yet still flexible, willing to move with me. And now Cuts is finally out with their new polos and hoodies made with their custom Hyperloop French Terry fabric. Try Cuts and save. Cuts is loved by your favorite athletes, entrepreneurs, and even podcast hosts. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. cutsclothing.com/Gordon. Thanks for being with us on this Halloween weekend. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, the risks and responsibilities of eating inside of restaurants. Also, a deep dive on the personal finances of average Americans. Plus, advice for dealing with relatives who go on and on about politics. And finally, a heartwarming Halloween story that involves tragedy and triumph. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. As temperatures drop and patios start to close, diners across the country will soon have to make up their own minds about whether to eat inside a restaurant or not. They are not easy decisions. And as Tim Carman at the Washington Post adds, there are no foolproof calculations. Tim, what inspired this story?
You know, it was sort of based on, you know, with the idea that patios are closing, and a lot of, you know, every day we keep getting more new information on the safety of eating indoors or being indoors in general. And I was just getting a lot of feedback from people talking about their levels of comfort. So I just started reaching out first via social media, and then on phone conversations with a number of people around the country, just on their thoughts about eating out. And it really varied. Some people are comfortable or semi-comfortable. Some people see no risk in dining indoors. And then I would say a really healthy part of the country is worried about it. And so I just kind of put it all in context and tried to put some like ethical framework around it. To talk to a couple of people that are specializing in ethics, and you know, do we need to save restaurants? Is that part of our responsibility as the restaurant industry is sort of dying on the vine? should we feel like it's our responsibility to save this industry?
That was an interesting point that that one person made. She was sort of feeling the pressure of feeling like it was part of her role to save restaurants. Didn't like it.
Yeah, totally. And you know, who can't feel that a little bit? You know, there is this sense among a number of people that, you know, the way that our country has handled the pandemic, you know, has put us in this position because, you know, you know, we didn't go into really hardcore lockdown like some other countries, and B, you know, there's fighting now among representatives of Congress on stimulus, which could help the restaurant industry kind of get over this hump. Yeah, because the winter is going to be really tough on restaurant industry. You know, they sort of survived, many of them, on patio dining, because a lot of cities helped expand patio dining. You know, they went into streets, they permitted sidewalks, so they were able to get more revenue with this. And in many cities, and particularly in colder climates, they're not going to be able to do that. I know they're trying to, you know, they're trying to get heaters, they're trying to do, you know, pods, they're trying to do whatever they can to extend the season on patio, but more than likely, much of that will shut down, so they'll lose this revenue stream. So what do you do? Like, how do you try to keep those revenues coming in during the colder months? And a lot of restaurateurs were looking towards a stimulus package, and it's not really clear that's going to come down the pike right now.
All right. We're speaking with Tim Carman, reporter and columnist for The Washington Post. He's written an insightful piece entitled "Diners: Weigh the Ethics, Risks, and Responsibilities of Eating Inside Restaurants." You know, something I hadn't considered too, we talk about it like we know about it, but we don't, and that's who understands these adequate air filters that are put in restaurants. You know, some people even consider that.
Yeah, you know, that's really complicated, right? It's like who among us really knows HVAC systems, heating and ventilation and air conditioning systems? You know, and I know restaurateurs are, you know, spending a lot of money to install these systems that are supposed to or designed to kill viruses, and they're promoting this. And, you know, if you look into some of the independent research on this, they look good. But, you know, that makes it on the puts it on the diner's perspective again to trust that these tests are accurate, that, you know, these systems work. And like, are there really any independent government sources that can go into these restaurants and say, and check out their systems and say, yes, you know what, 100%, this will kill 99.9% of the viruses that float through this restaurant, and you can safely sit here. I don't think anyone can do that, right?
Thanks, Tim. Tim Carman from The Washington Post. Coming up next, In Depth with Americans' Personal Finances. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. This year's pandemic has unleashed financial turmoil for many American families, so data from last year might seem irrelevant. Still, there's one set of 2019 data that deserves our attention. It's a survey that's perhaps the most in-depth look we get at the state of America's personal finances. In-depth analysis from Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, takeaways.
So the Federal Reserve, every 3 years, does something called the Survey of Consumer Finances. And what it does is it sits down with thousands of American families and interviews them in depth about how much they owe, in other words, their debts, what they currently own, and what sort of income they have. And they put this all together in this Survey of Consumer Finances, and it provides a snapshot of America's personal finances. And so the last one was just released. It was conducted in 2019, so it was conducted before the pandemic. But still, the numbers are relevant to today's situation. And for instance, one of the things that the survey found is that currently just under 53% of American families are invested in the stock market. And that number has remained remarkably steady for the past 20 years. If you look at the longer-term data, what you find is that in the 1990s, during that great bull market, we went from about 30% of Americans invested in the stock market to 50% of Americans invested in the stock market. And we've stayed there ever since, despite, you know, the dot-com bust of the early 2000s, despite the Great Recession and the big stock market decline we saw then, And I suspect when the next survey is done, we'll find that people hung tough despite the 34% market decline we saw earlier this year.
So I want to ask you about that number, because I've heard that number cited before, the roughly 53% of Americans invested in the stock market. Do you have any feel for the number of Americans who are eligible to be in the stock market but choose not to be?
Well, that's a good question. What we've seen over the years is that many more Americans have been investing in the stock market, but not through individual stocks, which is the way they used to invest it, you know, the way our fathers and grandfathers invested. Mm-hmm. It's through 401k plans. And so I think that 50% really reflects a change in the way that people are investing their 401ks and the access to those 401ks. I mean, one of the reasons the number probably isn't higher, and it's related to your question, Gordon, is that, of course, access to retirement accounts at the workplace is much lower. And so as a consequence, people aren't getting access to 401k plans or 403b plans. And as a result, they aren't investing in the stock market, because without those plans, they're not going to invest on their own.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece about the state of America's personal finances based on a new 3-year survey. What was a surprise to you when you started consuming this data?
Well, one of the big surprises is the decline in the interest in three key financial products. If you look at what's happened to interest in CDs, i.e. certificates of deposit, interest in savings bonds, and interest in cash value life insurance, and these were all standard financial products going back 30 years, but essentially over the past three decades, interest in these products have been cut in half. People simply aren't buying savings bonds, they aren't buying certificates of deposit, and they have far less interest in cash value life insurance than they did 30 years ago. That's a really big change in the financial landscape.
And why is that? Any feel?
Well, I think in the terms of certificates of deposit and savings bonds, it's to do with declining interest rates. You know, people used to go to their banks to be investors in the olden days when, you know, we had double-digit yields. Similarly, savings bonds had yields that were much more attractive. Now, if people are looking to earn interest, they're much more likely to go out and buy either an individual bond or a bond mutual fund. Meanwhile, in terms of cash value life insurance, I think what we're seeing here is the increasing availability of much cheaper term life insurance. You can go on a whole host of websites these days and get term insurance really cheaply, and that's making people rethink the virtues of cash value life insurance, where yes, you do build up wealth over time thanks to the growth of that cash value, mm-hmm. but the premiums, you know, maybe 8 or 10 times higher.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder of HumbleDollar.com. Coming up next, dealing with that one relative during election season. Today, I'm here with Josh Hunt, Executive Vice President and Chief Business Development Officer at MEDC, the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. Josh, what are Michigan's best selling points?
The biggest selling point for Michigan is our pure Michigan quality of life. We also have a diverse and abundant workforce and a business-friendly environment that we think is unmatched. It's also very connected to global supply chain assets. And through a comprehensive suite of programs and services, we can help businesses grow here in this state and also help provide access to our highly skilled workforce, where we have the highest concentration of engineers and some of the greatest skilled trades talent as well. Here in Michigan, we make things, and we think we can be the convergence of technology and manufacturing, and there is no better place to bring your idea or product from concept to reality than here in Michigan.
To hear more of this interview with Josh Hunt from MEDC, go to thismorningwithgordondeal.com and click on the MEDC microphone. Well, a couple of days from an election that has fueled more bitter divisions than America has seen in decades, it feels harder than ever to interact with people who have vastly different views. And as much as we might want to avoid these folks, it's not always possible or desirable, especially if they're friends or family. Strategies to get you through Election Day from Elizabeth Bernstein, relationship columnist at The Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, help us out.
Here's the thing. I feel really strongly about this, and I'm not the only one. The actual experts, the psychologists who followed this kind of issue feel really strongly about this, too. We need to get along with the people in our lives, and we can't let politics as dividing us as a nation. We cannot let it divide our relationships.
You know, I thought it was interesting. The expert you spoke to made a difference between what we're arguing about and what the real debate is about, something along those lines, right?
Exactly. So I interviewed a very interesting psychologist. Her name is Jeannie Safer, and she's written a book about what to do when you can't stand your loved one's politics. And she's a psychoanalyst. And so she speaks about the difference between manifest content is what we think we're talking about on the surface. Oh, I think I'm arguing about the sock on the floor. I'm so mad. My husband left it there. And then latent content is what I'm really arguing about, which is that he never listens when I tell him, please do this. So there's manifest content, what we think we're arguing about, and latent content, what we are really arguing about, which is our feelings. And we have to remember that now with politics. She says that the issue is not that we're arguing with, when we're arguing with a loved one over politics, the real disagreement is not politics, it's psychology. It's how can you see the world so differently from me?
Interesting. All right, so she said, too, that she's a believer that it's harder for people with different views to get along these days. Did she say why? Why we seem to be so much more polarized?
Sure, we're just, the whole country's polarized. We're in this environment where all anybody does is yell, basically. Nobody's listening. Social media is a big problem with this. You know, everybody thinks they can go on and just spout off and be nasty. Much of it's anonymous. Yeah. And so we're sort of in this world right now where the discourse, you know, for many reasons, is pretty nasty.
It was interesting, too. She said, hey, listen, you know, we're in a pandemic, too. Not helpful. None of this is helpful.
No, we're already isolated from a loved one. So much isolation from coworkers and people who, you know, we care about and extended family, and in some cases, close family. So we do not need more isolation to suddenly decide you're cutting off your sister because you can't stand her views. That's not right. You know what? Your sister's going to be hopefully be here a long time after whatever happens in this election happens.
We're speaking with Elizabeth Bernstein. She writes the Bonds column for the Wall Street Journal. This piece is called Loathe Your Loved One's Politics. Here's some advice. All right, so what's the basic guidance here so we can keep things civil?
So we have to remember, people think, one of our things that this expert explained is, we believe that everybody, you know, our intimates, our loved ones should be just like us. That never happens. In the history of the world, that's never happened. So it helps to remember that. It's okay that we have very significant differences with every single person in our life. Like, for example, we may have a spouse that stays up all night. I might go to bed in the morning. I mean, you know, wake up early. So these are important things to remember, that it's okay. It is normal that we do not agree. We do not have to agree. That's a major one. The next major one for right now, 2 weeks out of an election, is we want to avoid discussing politics right now. Nobody is changing their minds. You are not changing someone's mind just to argue and argue and argue. So you avoid it with your loved ones because you want to focus on what is good in the relationship, not a difference.
All right. So assuming the phrase, hey, shut up, is not a good way to approach this. How do you just tell someone, let's not discuss this?
You know, you basically say, hey, you know, we just see things differently. Or, you know, I love you. You know, I love spending time with you, but this is not something we can talk about fruitfully. Let's not fight about it. Let's enjoy ourselves. We've got enough problems right now. We are in a pandemic. That's basically how you say it. You say it with kindness, but, like, let's move on.
But some people are just going to persist.
Some people are going to persist, and then you can basically say, look, if someone's consistently, I think you're wrong, they're persisting, you say, look, there's a lot of different ways to look at this. You say something neutral. You don't give your opinion. You say there are a lot of different ways to look at this, and then you pivot. Hey, what's for dinner? That's right. So always a good, and if pizza's for dinner, you're even better off.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Elizabeth Bernstein, relationship columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Coming up next, a heartwarming Halloween story. Do business more powerfully during Dell's semi-annual sale. Save up to 45% on Dell computers and servers with Intel Core processors. Also, save on electronics and accessories, plus free shipping on everything and special financing with Dell Business Credit. Call 877-ASK-DELL to talk to a Dell Technologies advisor who can help you find just the right tech. That's 877-ASK-DELL or visit dell.com/businessdeals. And finally, Crystal Conover decorates her front yard every Halloween with creepy clowns, life-size skeletons, and zombies climbing out of grassy holes. It's in memory of her son, Jaden Rathbone. Jaden was 13 years old when he was hit by a car after a driver didn't see him trick-or-treating back in 2011 on a dark street in the small town of Uintah, Utah. After Jaden was killed, the Washington Post says Ms. Conover decided to go all out for Halloween at her home in Layton, Utah, because it was her son's favorite holiday. But 2020 has exhausted her. She said she didn't have the wherewithal to decorate, plus a storm caused about $4,000 in damage to her home last month. A couple of weeks ago, she told a few friends about skipping Halloween, but the neighbors were not having it. They showed up to clean her yard from the storm damage and help her put up the decorations. Her neighbors told her that they couldn't imagine Halloween without Ms. Conover's participation. And by the way, her neighbors also deck out their homes on Halloween in memory of Jaden. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. It's October, and what does that mean? Well, it's Geico-ween, of course. Don't be spooked by high rates on car insurance. Geico is brewing up spellbinding savings that they're crafting just for you. See how much you could save. Get a quote today at geico.com.